You're listening to the Newsmakers podcast from MLB.com.
This is the Rocket, Bill Ottson. Welcome to Newsmakers. We have a lot going on today. We have former Dodgers general manager Fred Claire. I went to the American League Championship Series between the Astros and Yankees, and I had conversations with Dallas Keuchel and George Springer. Richard Justice is back, and he gives us the latest news around the world of baseball. We then talk to Charlie Slows, and he tells us why the Nationals collapsed in Game 5 of the National League Division Series against the Cubs. And then we talk to Orioles legend Boog Powell. We start with Fred Claire, who compares the 2017 Dodgers to the 1988 Dodgers. Enjoy the podcast.
On the phone is former Dodgers GM Fred Claire. He is the last person to build a world championship in Los Angeles in 1988, and he's on the phone right now. Fred, thank you so much for being on the phone.
Good to be with you.
Okay, what do you think of this current Dodger team right now?
I love it. I love the team, I've really gotten to know Dave Roberts. I just think the world of him and the way that he has managed this team. But it's really an exceptional team in that there's so much athletic talent on this team. And obviously there are some really incredibly good young players. But it's just a team that is very much together, and the record reflects that. They're now 6-0 in the postseason games, and as hot as a team can be.
Now, let me ask you this. You know, people are saying that this is the best Dodger team in history. Now, you've been around the Dodgers for a lot of years. Is this the best team?
Oh, I think, Bill, that's very hard to say, because when you think about the Dodgers and the Los Angeles Dodgers and some of the great, great teams, I mean, when you think about the Koufax and Drysdale and Maury Wills period, and when you think about Garvey, Lopes, Russell, Say, I mean, that was an incredibly good team. I mean, where you had basically the same lineup that went out there every day. You can't say this is the best team. This may be certainly one of the most athletic teams, and really a team built for the times, with starting pitchers going fewer innings, with players being able to play multiple positions. The changes in the game have been somewhat dramatic when you look back. But the talent on this team is undisputable.
Now, when they went on that long losing streak, did you have any concerns, or did you think they would put it in order?
Well, you can't help but have concerns. As good as the team had played, when you're losing that many games, and I know that feeling of when a team is struggling, that you're really saying to yourself, as Dave Roberts had to be saying, oh my gosh, when are we going to win a game to get out of this?
Uh-huh.
So they went through a terrible, terrible period. But I think that what happened was that coming back and then playing so strong, it just uplifted the confidence level of the team that you can see. And so now they're so aggressive in every way. They're so aggressive with their at-bats. There's so much confidence when you see those relief pitchers come in. And, of course, they've got a closer who's the best in the game,
mm-hmm.
In Kenley Jansen. So he's just shutting the door on the opponents.
No doubt. You know, can you believe it? 1988, that was the last time the Dodgers won a World Series, and you had a hand in that. Can you believe it's 29 years ago already?
No, because the memories of that year are very, very visible. So the mark that team established in becoming the fifth Los Angeles team to win a world championship. So it's very much certainly in the minds of the Dodger fans, because the Dodger team of this year and the past teams that have been in the postseason in recent years have had to live with the statement that continues to be there, that the Dodgers haven't won since 1988. So I'm sure they're tired of hearing that. They're tired of hearing about 1988. I know the fans treasure the great memories of 1988. But clearly this team is out to establish its own mark, and it certainly put itself in a position to enter the World Series, and no matter who they play, this team is certainly going to be ready for the challenge.
You know, the thing that sticks out about that team, the 88 team, was that not only did you sign Kirk Gibson, which was your biggest signing, but you improved that bullpen by getting Jay Howell, Jesse Orozco. I'll never forget that. And then you emphasized pitching and defense. That wasn't a good hitting team. It was not. But you emphasized pitching and defense, and it really worked. Could you talk about that?
Well, we needed, after 87, in both 1986 and 1987, we finished each of those seasons 16 games under 500. I mean, we were at the bottom of the pile. And so there were three areas that we just had to improve and that I set out to improve. One was to have a reliable shortstop, and we had that shortstop, and we made the trade that brought us Alfredo Griffin. The other thing that we needed was a closer, and that closer came in the same deal, and that was Jay Howe, and we needed left-handed help in the bullpen, and, of course, that was Jesse Orozco. So all three of those arriving in one trade, but there were some pieces that came together before that in the previous year in 87. One of the first trades that I made was to acquire John Shelby. And in many ways, the play of Chris Taylor in center field is kind of reminiscent of John Shelby, because Shelby gave us a huge, huge lift in both 87 and 88. A lot of fans really didn't know that much about John Shelby. A lot of fans didn't know that much about Chris Taylor. Mm-hmm. The center fielder actually started at shortstop last night. So but to your point, we did have the pitching. We had a player who had a dominant season, won the Cy Young Award in Oral Hershiser.
Right.
The other thing that team had was two other outstanding starters. People often overlook the pitching of Tim Leary and the pitching of Tim Belcher, who I had acquired at the end of the 87 season. So pitching and defense certainly was a part of that. Those starting pitchers and the bullpen was a big part of that. The play of John Shelby in center field was a big part of that. And Alfredo Griffin really did stabilize our defense. So you're right. It was pitching and defense. And then with a player who came in that I signed, who went on to win the MVP, and, of course, that was Kirk Gibson.
What made you decide to sign Kirk Gibson? He was a guy, he was from Detroit, born and raised, and he helped the Tigers win a championship. What made you decide to sign him?
Well, I spent a lot of time with talking to our scouts, and a great scout in the Detroit area in Michigan who had seen Kirk through his college career and knew Kirk very well, a gentleman by the name of Dale McReynolds, certainly a legendary scout in Dodger history, was so high. I can remember calling Dale and reading the reports that he had turned in on Kirk. And Dale was a very conservative scout. But I went back to look at all of his reports from the time Kirk was in college and then tracking him then when he was with Detroit. And I said, Dale, I've never seen you grade a player this high in terms of what he brings to a team, not only what he does in terms of the individual categories of running, power, et cetera, but just what he adds to a team. And he said, Fred, he said, there are very few players that I've ever seen who play with this type of intensity, and yes, this is what I see, and based on Dale's words and our other scouting reports, I knew that Kirk was a player, or felt that Kirk was a player who could make a very big difference for us, and he certainly did.
Now, I remember I was living in L.A. when you guys went to the World Series, and I remember Bob Costas calling it the weakest team to go to the World Series. But my question to you is, why were you guys able to beat the Mets and Athletics, and they were heavily favored to beat you guys in the postseason? Talk about that.
Well, this team, the 2017 Dodgers, are reminiscent because it's to the degree that with the 88 team, there was definitely a unity there. The players that came off our bench, if you'll recall, were labeled the stuntmen.
Correct.
I mean, you had players like Mickey Hatcher. When our shortstop Alfredo went down, Dave Anderson came in. When Socha couldn't play at times, Rick Dempsey was there. So we really had a very, very unified team. And clearly, that's what it takes. Now, you may succeed or you may not succeed in terms of certainly winning a world championship or advancing in postseason play. But when you have that type of togetherness, you really have something. And that's what I see in this year's Dodger team. And I cannot single out Dave Roberts enough for the way that he has handled this team and the way that he has been able to bring all of these players together. He's just done a tremendous job. They have that cohesive feeling. They have that spirit. It's evident. And it was even evident in terms of when they were struggling that this was a team that was together. You didn't read a lot in the media about players complaining. You hadn't read stories about players not being in the lineup or having to change a position. We had that similar team in 88.
Wow, that's amazing. You know what, Fred Claire, I got to tell you, you are more than just a GM. You've had a great career while living in Los Angeles. You were a journalist, and then you worked in the Dodgers PR. You came up with Think Blue. I mean, what a career! Could you talk about how you thrived in Los Angeles?
Well, I was blessed to receive an opportunity with the Dodgers in 1969, and you're right. I had been covering the team, and then I had a chance to join the Dodgers as the publicity director, and advanced from the publicity director to the vice president of public relations and promotions, to the executive vice president, where I had a hand in overseeing baseball and the business operation, to becoming the general manager in 1987. So it was a small staff. I was very fortunate to work in an organization that had the great ownership and the leadership of Walter O'Malley and Peter O'Malley, to be with them, to have the opportunity to be with legendary people and to learn from them, like Walter Alston and Al Campanis and Bill Schweppe and Red Patterson, legendary people in the game, and to be there with them on a daily basis and to learn from them, and great scouts and great minor league personnel, legendary people, many who went on to manage on our minor league staff other teams. I love the game. I've always loved the game since I first saw my first major league game at Crosley Field in Cincinnati. So I was passionate about it. I loved the opportunity. And what I tried to do every day that I had the job was to give the very best effort that I had. So I feel very blessed that I was able to spend 30 years with the organization.
What are you doing now?
I stay busy on a number of fronts. I'm chairman of a company, Scoutables, that's a top analytics company that was started by my partner, Ari Kaplan, one of the foremost people in that area. We're looking deeply and have talked to a number of teams in Major League Baseball about disability insurance, which would enable all clubs to insure each and every player on their 40-man roster, which I think could be something that would be extremely beneficial to the teams in terms of kind of ensuring the their payrolls and what that would mean and not be devastated by an injury that takes away a high-paid player. I've been active in teaching. I wanted to give back. I wanted to give to the students, so I've been involved with sports programs at USC, at Long Beach State, at Fordham, and at the very prestigious Caltech here in Pasadena where I live. I'm also on the board of the Rose Bowl Operating Company, so teaching, civic responsibilities, and then I've had a battle with cancer over the last year, and in August of this year had a tournament to benefit the City of Hope and had an incredible turnout of Major League players and other celebrities where we were able to raise a significant amount of money for the City of Hope. So I stay very busy doing the things that I've always enjoyed, baseball, people, sports, education. Those are the things that that drive me and that I thrive on.
That's really great. Fred Claire, listen, thank you so much for being on the show. We hope to have you on again.
Bill, anytime. Take good care.
You too now. Thank you.
My next guest is lefty Dallas Keuchel, and he explains why the Astros went from one of the worst teams in the league to World Series contenders. Enjoy the podcast. First of all, I got to ask, What was it like to watch Verlander yesterday?
Oh, it was special. I mean, that's why we got him. He's a veteran pitcher with a proven track record, and we brought him over here for a reason. That was to win, and now we're winning ball games, and thankful to have him.
What is the biggest thing you learned from him? He's a veteran. He's in his 30s now. And what have you learned from him?
One, his the way he goes about his business, and I've always been a routine-oriented guy as well since I've been in the league. But the way he values his routine, his body, the way he goes about his business on the analytical side, the mental side. That's something you can always try to strive to be better at, and that's probably the biggest thing right now.
Is it hard to believe how far this team has come? You step away from the World Series. What's the difference between this team and 2015?
Well, we honestly weren't that good in 2015.
You don't think so?
We had a tremendous pitching staff. Mm-hmm. We had timely hitting. That was it. Mm-hmm. We played good defense. So when you couple good defense, good pitching, and timely hitting, you're going to be in positions that you never thought you would be in, and that's where we were. We beat the Yankees in the wild card game here, and we opened a lot of people's eyes, but I think we kind of fooled ourselves at the same time. So that way, 2016 rolls around, we had pretty much the same team, and we had a decent season, but we kind of fell flat on our face from the expectations of our own selves.
What do you think was the turning point to make this team one of the best teams in the league?
Well, we got smart veteran players who are still producing at a high level, and when you couple guys who have so much knowledge of the game and share it unconditionally with some of the younger guys, and the younger guys showing willingness to accept that and then try to be a better player, it just makes everybody better, and that's one of the biggest keys. And that's you can't see that in the box score. You can't see that in the everyday clubhouse. It just builds over time.
One stat that people are bringing up are the strikeouts from the position players. You guys were one of the worst teams, and now you guys rarely strike out now. I mean, what a difference.
Yeah, I think plate discipline is a big factor in that. I think there's, like I said, there's guys with willingness to be knowledgeable about what guys throw, what percentage they throw strikes, and this and that. So when you got guys willing to learn every day and take their job seriously, going out and trying to compete against the best pitchers in the world, you get more knowledgeable. And if you gain that knowledge and take it with good use, you got a good team.
How's your season gone overall, the entire year, you think? I know you've had some injuries, but still the stats are nice.
Yeah, I mean, stats are always nice when you're doing well. So the last thing I want to do was be hurt, and I started off really well. And it's just unfortunate that I missed 8 weeks, but that's in the past, and got back on track. So we're here now and just enjoying it.
I mean, think about when you first came into the major leagues. This team was not very good. And are you still in disbelief how far this team has come?
Yeah, a little bit. But at the same time, when you get opportunities and take advantage of them, you love to be around the clubhouse every day, and it seems like just yesterday it was 2012. So I cherish each and every day, and love seeing Marwin, Altuve, those guys who I've grown up with, see them prosper as well, and really just become household names and stars in their own right. When my career is all said and done, I'm going to look back at some of the best times here in the clubhouse and say to myself, I was really, really fortunate to play with such good players.
I'm happy for A.J. Hinch. I'm happy that he was given a second chance, because he wasn't really given a chance in Arizona. How happy are you for him, and what's it like to work for him?
I'm happy for anybody who gets a second chance and is willing to put in the time and effort to get better themselves. And coaching staff's no different. It's you're not playing, but at the same time, you can become a better coach, and you can become a better manager. And I think with the right situation he has here, it's pretty easy to get along with our guys. And in turn, it's pretty easy to get along with AJ.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
George Springer's next. And let me tell you, he loves hitting leadoff for the Astros. Here's what he had to say.
George, thank you so much for talking to me. First of all, is it hard to believe how far you guys have come? Like 2014, and even before that, you guys were one of the worst teams in the league, and now you guys are a step away from the World Series. How do you feel?
It's great. You know, this team has gone through a lot over the last 4 or 5 years, mm-hmm. and you know, to be in this position now, is special to us. You know, we understand it. We kind of embrace it and just try to have fun.
Now you are the leadoff hitter. And talk about your season. It's been a great year, over 30 homers. Do you wish to hit in the middle of the order?
No, I like hitting first, and I like to try to set the tone, you know, mm-hmm. for the guys up behind me. I got the best hitter in the game up behind me in Altuve, mm-hmm. and you know, a guy like Correa, Josh Reddick, Heltron, you know, Ariel, mm-hmm. Arwin Gonzalez, you know,
right.
There's a lot of guys up behind me who can hit. So, you know, I like to just set the tone, you know, try to get to first base.
Now, think about the stat a minute. This team finished first in the least amount of strikeouts. Why is that?
I don't know. You know, I think as an offense, you know, we believe in getting a pitch to hit and hitting it. You know, don't miss. You know, kind of be a tough out and grind as many pitches at, you know, at bats as you can and you know, put it in play.
Now, talk about working for A.J. Hinch. I mean, that's a great coup, it turns out.
Yeah, you know, he's a great guy. You know, he treats us as men. You know, he only asks us to play the game the right way, and you can't ask for more. You know, he always asks you how you are. You know, he wants to know, you know, how you are on and off the field. He's very in tune with every player. You know, he knows how each guy works, and that's huge on a team of 25 plus guys. You know, to know how each guy works is a credit to him. You know, he gets to know all of his players on a very personal level.
Now, George, you made the All-Star team. Tell me what that feeling was like. You ended up having a great year. Tell me how you felt about your year.
You know, I'm happy with it, but you know, there are some things that I think, you know, I could have done better, but that's, you know, that's the game of baseball. You know, I think I improved a lot in some certain areas, and so, you know, that's obviously the goal is you know, to improve in every direction and keep getting better every year.
What do you want to do better?
Everything. You know, I know that sounds cliche, but you know, mm-hmm. there isn't anything in this game that I can say that I have figured out. So, you know, I want to be better in all aspects of the game.
Now, do you have family in Puerto Rico? And if so, how are they doing?
Yeah, my mom's family, or, you know, my family is she's got some cousins there, you know, some aunts and uncles of hers. And they're doing better. You know, they were hit pretty hard, but they're alive and safe, which is obviously the most important part.
Are they back in the States or?
No, they're still there now. You know, they wanted to stay and help.
Now, and how's your mother doing?
She's hanging in there. She, uh-huh. you know, she wants to go help and you know, to be there for them. But you know, I'm glad that she's safe and you know, but she's having a hard time.
Now you have a bunch of people on this team who have family in Puerto Rico. And how do you guys manage to stay focused?
I don't know how they do it. Things in life come before this game, and you know, for them to be able to play and, you know, to do their job, you know, ahead of a tragedy is impressive.
Now, well, I just want to tell you that you are a hero to a lot of people. Like myself, you know, when I was a kid, I had a stuttering problem. How do you get over it? Do you surround yourself with positive people?
Yeah, you know, you just surround yourself with good quality people. And you just have to go out and, you know, live your life. You know, it's a thing that you can't control, so you might as well not be worried about it.
What's next for George Springer?
You know, we have a big game up tomorrow, so I'm going to start with that.
Hey, congratulations.
Thank you.
Richard Justice is my next guest, and he expects Alex Cora to get a managerial job this offseason. Here's what Richard had to say. On the phone is the best baseball writer in America. His name is Richard Justice. He's a columnist for MLB.com. Richard, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Bill.
Richard, I want to start off with Alex Cora. He is the bench coach of the Astros, and his name has been floating about like nobody's business. And let me tell you, it seems like he's going to get a job as a manager. And what do you think about him?
I think he could not be more qualified. I think it's a great thing for him, and it's a great thing for the game of baseball. My guess is he's going to take the Red Sox job. I think he'll have his choice of the Mets job as well, maybe others. As A.J. Hinch said, he's going to be interviewed for every opening on the planet. Here are his qualifications. He was raised in Puerto Rico. Baseball's been his whole life. His father was heavily involved in baseball. His brother played a long time. His older brother, Joey, played a long time in the big leagues. Alex played for 14 years, six organizations. He played for Terry Francona, who had a huge impact on him. He played for Jim Tracy. He played for your guy, Davey Johnson. Davey was the first guy to say to him, Alex, you're going to play every day. Davey was the first guy to say to him, Alex, you're not going to play anymore. The kids are going to play. You've seen it. You've seen the game for every angle. He interviewed with the Padres, the Diamondbacks, and the Rangers, and they all said to him, you don't have any experience, even though any experience off the field, even though he had the immediate experience with ESPN. He'd been a GM and a manager for the Puerto Rican WBC team. Little point of trivia, he even fired himself as manager. So he's gotten used to that part of it when he was trying to hold down both jobs. He is great with the media. He's great with players. He knows the game. And I think, when those three teams told him you don't have enough experience. So he came to Houston, left ESPN. The Astros had tried to hire him prior. They tried to hire him when they brought in Bo Porter as manager. And they tried to, and A.J. Hinch had talked to him a couple of times. And he just said, I need this year on my resume. And now he's going to be a managerial job. It's a great gig. An interesting thing, let me tell you a little story about how he first met A.J. Hinch. 2012, A.J. was working for the Padres. They had the seventh pick in the draft. And Alex was running a combine down in Puerto Rico in his hometown, Caguas. And A.J. was watching the game with him. They'd come to see this kid, the 17-year-old shortstop. The kid shortstop hits a home run in his first at-bat. The kid shortstop hits a home run in his second at-bat. A.J. Hinch picked up his phone, called the Padres traveling secretary, and said, get me a plane ticket home tonight. And Alex said, well, what? You don't want to see any more of the kid? And he goes, we're picking seventh. That kid will be long gone by then. And that kid was Carlos Correa, so their paths crossed. Yeah, I couldn't be more bullish. You never know what happens when the guy moves that one seat over. But in terms of qualifications, Alex Cora is ready to be a manager. I love the guy.
We stay here in Texas, and we learn that the Rangers are not going to pick up the option of Mike Napoli. Now, Mike Napoli was supposed to be a guy that would take Texas to the next level because he did that with other teams, including the Texas Rangers. What happened with Mike Napoli this year?
The pitching happened, I think. Maybe Mike is at the end of the line. I don't know. But when you bring in Mike Napoli, you don't bring him in strictly for things that can be measured by numbers. The guy has a way of unifying a clubhouse. We saw it. We've seen it every place he's been. Indians, Rangers, Red Sox. The Rangers maybe are in a different spot. I don't know if they're going to contend next year. And if you're not going to contend, you don't want. I think you feel like maybe younger players could get those Napoli at bats. But the reason they didn't succeed this year, and Mike's numbers weren't great, but the reason they didn't succeed is that their pitching was just in a book. Their bullpen was not competitive enough.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I got to tell you this. Watching this ALCS with you, Richard, I got to tell you, I think Joe Girardi's playing with house money. I think he's done a great job. And do you see him coming back?
Oh, I can't see him managing anyplace else. No, the only thing would be, does he still want to manage? And I would guess he does. The Yankees, for all what they were in the 70s and 80s, they are a fountain of stability in terms of how Steinbrenner and Brian Cashman have a vision for what they're doing and how they're going to do it. And Joe is perfect for that. It started with Joe Torre, the first Yankee manager that I know of that kept in the Steinbrenner era, that kept all the noise out in the hallway, made it just about baseball, made it normal. And that's what Joe has done, too. If you're, you think about it, all these young guys are running out there, and they've not all, every day hasn't been sunshine for Aaron Judge and Greg Bird and Gary Sanchez. But there is a feeling, when you're around the Yankees now, you feel like you're around just a baseball team. Mm-hmm. And, of course, it's not just a baseball team, but it feels that way. And that's the manager setting a tone of professionalism, and we don't care what the tabloids say, we don't care what you guys think, we're just going to go do the best thing for our group. And that's why I'm a huge fan. They know they could not get anybody better than Joe.
As we record this, the Dodgers have a 3-0 lead in the NLCS. what do you think about this Dodger team? They really look impressive.
Yeah, there was a time, you know, maybe 2 months ago when you'd said to me, who's the National League MVP? Well, I would have given you Anthony Rendon and Chris Bryant, Joey Votto, John Carlos Stanton, and then half the Dodgers. They got a franchise year out of Turner, out of Chris Taylor. And Turner and Chris Taylor are both reclamation projects. Chris Taylor, amazing. He reinvented his swing last year. Guys like Bellinger and Seager. And they just stacked up pitching on top of pitching on top of pitching. They are, I don't know if they're a perfect team, but in terms of bullpen depth, rotation depth, and just an offense that wears you out up and down the lineup, they're as good as it comes. And they've been that way pretty much since opening day, even though they went through a little 1-16 slump.
Oh, yeah, I know. Hey, were you surprised by what happened to the Indians? Everyone thought they were going to the World Series, but they're out of it now. What do you think is ahead for them?
I think they're going to keep the band together again. Something was going on with Corey Kluber at the end. I don't know whether he was healthy or how you would look at that, but I think they're a really good team, and what was revealed was a lot of pitching depth. Their bullpen's really good. I think the future's bright. They just come back. I would keep the band together, and I bet they do that, and let Terry Francona give it another run.
How much are you enjoying the ALCS?
I'm enjoying all the playoffs. You know, the games are tense. Yankee Stadium is starting to sound like Yankee Stadium of old, that thunderclap of ovation and that edginess to the crowd that is so intimidating. I think it's been great theater to watch.
Richard Justice, you're the best. Listen, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you, Bill.
Charlie Slows is my next guest, and he's still in shock that the Nationals lost to the Cubs in the division series. Here's what he had to say.
He's one of the best baseball broadcasters in America. His name is Charlie Slows. He's the voice of the Nationals. You can hear him on 106.7 The Fan in Washington, D.C. Charlie, thank you so much for being on the show.
You're welcome, Bill. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Charlie, this is a shock. Are you still in shock about what happened with the Nationals last week?
I have to say, it's a stunning finish. I mean, the things that happened in that game are things you see once in a while. Never all together in one inning like that fifth inning the Nationals had when the game changed, and some other things that even happened later. It's certainly a stunner. I thought the Nationals had the better team to win that series. There are certainly chances that they missed offensively that night and in other games in a relatively pitching-dominated series until you have a 9-8 game to finish the series. Watching the NLCS now, you know, I'd like to think the Nationals would be putting up a better fight than what the Cubs have done so far against the Dodgers.
I agree with you on that. Charlie, what shocked me when I watched that game was the play of Matt Wieters. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. Matt Wieters looked like he was done. He was finished because he had problems catching the ball. He had problems hitting the ball. Was it shocking to see what he did? Now, I know he's a valuable receiver. People have talked about it all year. But how shocking was that?
Well, you know, the strikeout pass ball, I don't know if there was a cross-up. He did get hit on the backswing on that pitch. And, of course, the umpire could have called that and didn't in his judgment. It didn't affect him catching the ball. Mm-hmm. But still, to me, anytime a guy gets whacked in the backswing and there's a play, that usually favors the catcher. I mean, what condition is he after he gets hit on the backswing to go chase a ball that he ended up throwing into right field? That was crazy. Then to see catcher's interference with the next batter. Wieters always positions himself pretty close to the hitter, mm-hmm. and he gets hit on a lot of backswings with hitters who have long follow-throughs. So that wasn't the first time he got hit on the backswing. It's the first time he got called for catcher's interference all year.
Right.
So, just a combination of things that all happened at a bad time with Max Scherzer pitching on what looked like he had the third out on the ninth pitch of the inning on a ground ball to shortstop. Turner going to his left slipped on the outfield grass, which was wet from the rain, the misting rain all night. And, I mean, if he stays on his feet, he throws out Wilson Contreras with ease, and that inning's over. Three up, three down, and none of that ever happens. So that makes it even all more amazing in what happened. And then after the catcher's interference, you have Max Scherzer hitting John Jay in the foot with the bases loaded to force in a run.
Right.
And, you know, then to see that those three things, strikeout, pass ball, catcher's interference, next batter hit by pitch with the bases loaded, never happened in a single half inning that anyone can document.
Right. Unbelievable.
In how many innings of baseball?
Yeah.
It is unbelievable.
Charlie, I thought, you know, you mentioned this earlier, I thought that this Nationals team was the best team they've had. I mean, if you remember, I had told you I thought the 2014 team was their best team, but this team, I mean, the way they hit all year, I mean, it was like watching Murderers Row, and I'm stunned. I thought they were going to really go past the first round this time, and they just didn't. It was shocking. Could you talk about how good this team was?
Yeah, they were a really good team, considering they won 97 games with all the players that they had hurt and out of the lineup at different times all year, from Jason Worth in June to Trey Turner the end of June, all the way to the end of August, and then Bryce Harper from mid-August to the end of the year. Adam Eaton went down in late April, never came back with season-ending knee injury. Mm-hmm. Michael Taylor got hurt right after Turner did early July, strains an oblique. He's out for 6-7 weeks. Brian Goodwin replaces him as the center fielder and everyday leadoff hitter in place of both Turner in the leadoff spot and Taylor in center field. And right when about Taylor comes back, Goodwin gets hurt, pulls strains a groin muscle and didn't play another regular season game. He did get into a postseason game, was on the roster. But again, they lost him for a long stretch. And so they didn't have any continuity with a lot of the players going in and out of the lineup. You did have Murphy in there just about every day. Zimmerman had maybe the best year of his career, dating all the way back to 2006, his first full season. Rendon had a tremendous year, hit the best of his career, and was in the lineup almost every day consistently. So they did have some of the guys that, you know, played 145 games or more when you're looking at Zimmerman, Rendon, Murphy. The loss of Harper was big in trying to get him back in top form for a postseason series. But, you know, they until the last game when they scored 8 runs, they didn't hit a lot. They scored 5 runs in game 4 with a Taylor grand slam in the 8th inning. Mm-hmm. But neither team hit for average in that series. And, you know, the last game is just, to me, an insane game. I think 4 hours and 37 minutes was the longest 9-inning game for time in postseason history.
Right.
Just a lot of things happened in that game that you might never, ever see in one single postseason game again.
Charlie, the team is still good enough to win another division next year. What holes do they need to fix?
Well, I mean, some of the things that you would look to fix are determined by contractual situations when you look at it right away. You mentioned catching situation. Wieters has a player option at $10.5 million. The year before, his last year with the Orioles, he took the offer.
Qualifying offer.
The qualifying offer at $17 million and spent his last year with the Orioles and then basically was unsigned most of the winter to the Nationals, signed him to that 2-year deal, but a 1-year guaranteed with a player option for the second year at $10.5 million. Based on his offensive numbers, you would think he takes that player option. Then the Nationals have to decide, you know, was this an off year for him? Do they mix in someone else to share more of the playing time with him? You know, that's going to be a question they can't really answer until Wieters decides whether he takes the player option or becomes a free agent. Jose Lobaton, who backed him up, is also a free agent. Pedro Severino was their top prospect catcher but was hurt most of the year at AAA, and so didn't get extensive playing time, did play a little bit in September. They really don't have another big league ready catcher at this point. Rowdy Reed is their next best catching project and was called up in September, but he's never played above the double A level and only played in a couple of games and had, I think, 6 or 7 at bats off the bench in September. So, you know, question would be, do they go out and get another veteran catcher to go with Matt Wieters if he picks up that option? And if he doesn't, you know, they might be at square one trying to figure out that position, which is a huge one for any team.
And it also looks like, Charlie, now they need at least two back-in-the-end starters. You know, what do you think? We know Joe Ross is not going to be there because of Tommy John surgery. What do you think?
I think they might need one veteran starting pitcher. They need some depth. They really didn't have that with a veteran that they could call up from AAA, and a lot of teams don't. So someone to step right in. They didn't go get another starting pitcher during the season after they had signed Edwin Jackson and brought him up after the Joe Ross injury. A.J. Cole had the spot starts and pitched, you know, well at times in the role he was in, but I don't know if that's the guy you want to count on for the fifth starter spot at this point of his career. Maybe. There's Eric Fetty, too, who they shut him down in September. He had a forearm strain, and I think they thought he'd thrown enough innings. They monitored his innings all year long coming back from Tommy John surgery. Is he ready to compete and be the number five starter? Or do you need to go get a guy to really be insurance, whether you bring back Edwin Jackson as a free agent or not, also whether he would be in the mix. But, you know, I think they'll look to add a starter to the rotation, or at least someone who could be a guy that could swing back and forth, possibly be a starter or a long man out of the bullpen. I think they need to do that to really have some insurance. In the event that Fetty's not ready, they really don't have the depth for someone to step into that spot right now.
Charlie, do you think Dusty Baker will be back? I think he deserves to be back. He did a hell of a job this year, and I say that because when you didn't have a bullpen during the first half, somehow Dusty Baker willed this team to win, and I think that he should be back, but what's your take?
Well, I think he will. I mean, it's a unique situation that comes to the end of the season, and you're not hearing anything about it. You think that maybe something's worked out, that they can't announce it now. You can't make announcements without permission from commissioner's office during the postseason, or unless there's an off day in between, you know, LCS and the World Series, that kind of thing. I mean, the Red Sox did it when they announced the firing of John Farrell, had to get permission from Major League Baseball. So maybe this is all in the works. Maybe it's just, you know, you'd think waiting to dot I's and cross T's in all of this. But, you know, who knows when you've gone this long to this point where it really stands, because the Nationals are very close to the vest in how they handle these kind of things. You would think he'd be back, and that, you know, the Nationals, you know, as I said to Dusty after that game five, ran into him in the parking lot outside the ballpark, said, sorry, Dusty. And he goes, well, you know, there's only so much a manager can do. You can't play for him, you know. And that's how he feels. He wished there was something more he could do. You can't catch the ball for somebody or make the throw for somebody in those situations. It's, you know, it's the manager sometimes is like a dad watching his son. You got to let him go.
Yeah, I
and
know.
hope that they perform up to their level. You know, it's unfortunate for Dusty because he still has that stigma attached from past managerial stints with other clubs, where, you know, the Reds, they didn't get out of the first round. And you go back to the Giants, and gosh, he was so close to winning a World Series against the Angels and had the game slip away. And then his time with the Cubs, you had the Bartman thing in Chicago. And,
right,
you know, eventually that team had all the injuries to the pitching. And, you know, his last year they had a losing record there before he left Chicago to go to Cincinnati. I mean, he's managed a lot of games. He's won a lot of games. One more year could put him over, you know, 2,000 in wins for his career, and every manager that has 2,000 wins is in the Hall of Fame, whether they won a World Series or not.
Right, no question. Hey, listen.
I think it's hard to be judged just on postseason.
Right.
I think it helps push a lot of things over the top for someone in Hall of Fame consideration. But really, if you think about it, if it wasn't Dusty Baker, what direction would they go with this team right now,
right,
as far as a manager is concerned?
Wow. Well, listen to Charlie Slows. I mean, he is the best play-by-play voice I ever heard, and he's on 106.7 The Fan. Charlie, thank you so much for being on the show.
All right, Bill. Talk with you soon.
Take care.
My final guest is Boo Powell. He was a legend with the Orioles. He had a lot to say about his time there.
On the phone, it's an honor to have one of the best Orioles of all time. His name is Boog Powell. He was the great first baseman in the 1960s and 70s. Boog, thank you so much for being on the show.
My pleasure, Bill.
Buga, I want to talk to you about, first, about your barbecue place. It's a popular place. It's at Camden Yards. And talk about the food and everything. I know you're having fun doing it.
Yeah, it's been quite an experience. After after I got through playing baseball, I retired in 77. Or actually, I didn't retire. The Dodgers took my uniform away from me.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't let me play anymore. So at any rate, I was in the marina business for almost 15 years. And then the opportunity came up in Baltimore to get involved in the barbecue business. And I've been trying to find a way to do it at the old ballpark.
Right.
And we just couldn't put it together over there. So Camden Yards was built in 92. And I guess I just kept beating on the door. And we finally put it all together. And this past year was our 25th year cooking pit beef and pork tenderloin and turkey and all the trimmings that go along with it.
I know they taste good. There's no question about that. What's ahead for the barbecue place? Because it seems like everyone talks about it and they go to it on a regular basis.
Well, number one, it's really good food. I've developed the recipes over the years. I did a cookbook back in 86 or so, and I have some knowledge. I'm not certainly a world-class chef by any means, but I do understand what it takes to make good barbecue.
Wow.
And we do it there, and I make myself part of the deal every night, and I come out and sign autographs for about an hour every single night, and I meet a lot of folks from New York.
Wow.
We got some great barbecue eaters from New York.
Yeah, I'm one of them. I'm one of them. Hey, you know what sticks out with me? Two things. When you were a player, was the way you hit the ball the opposite way for power. That was amazing. And also, what people don't talk about, even though you're a big man, I thought you had some speed. And that goes unnoticed. I thought you were pretty fast. What'd you think of your game?
Well, like you said, I thought I was a little faster than people thought. And just because I was big and everything else, they associate you with being clumsy to go along with it. But kind of like the big guy that you got in New York now, and Judge, and
mm-hmm.
I'm not that category. I wasn't that fast, I don't think. But I was pretty quick, and I think I had 9 or 10 stolen bases one year. And when Earl Weaver took over the ball team in 68, he gave me the green light, and he said, if they're playing behind you, just go ahead and take off. So I did
mm-hmm.
from time to time, and I think I had 9 in a row, and I hurt my wrist one day, and he said, hey, he says, let's cut out the stealing, because I'd rather have you swinging the bat than getting hurt sliding on, putting yourself on the ground. So.
Right.
So anyway, I did pride myself on hitting the ball the other way. It was pretty hard to pitch me away.
Mm-hmm.
And that was pretty much it. I tried to be a complete ball player. I thought that the thing that helped me out the most, or would help our ball club out the most, was me driving in runs,
mm-hmm.
not striking out. And I just... I didn't strike out, I wasn't perfect about that, but I think I only struck out over 100 times once in all the years that I played.
Wow.
And I used to pride myself in driving in runs, and I think the final count was every 5.5 times to the plate I drove in a run.
Wow.
Which I'm pretty proud of that. That's pretty good, I think.
Well, that's great. Hey, you know what? Another thing, too, I can't forget. You won the MVP in 1970, and for a great Orioles team as well. Could you talk about that year, and why were you able to lead the league in everything?
Yeah, we had a great team, and I think that we had more of a team concept. you know, than anything. And I think Earl Weaver said one time that maybe Don Buford was the MVP. You know, because that's the kind of team we were. And Don Buford could have been the MVP because he had a wonderful year as a leadoff hitter that year.
Right.
And he walked like 108 times, and, you know, he hit almost 20 home runs and drove in 70 runs or so leading off and everything else. But every time I looked up, there was somebody on second base. Mm-hmm. I mean, almost every time. Wow. And I was swinging the bat pretty good, and I had guys hitting around me and behind me. Of course, I was hitting behind Frank Robinson most of the time, and then Ann Brooksy too. And so, you know, there was a little bit of protection afforded there for all of us, and so we could all excel. And that was the name of the game, is excelling as a team.
Of the 2 years you won, what was the one you think about the most, 66 or 1970?
Well, 66 was certainly a wonderful year, and we swept the Dodgers four straight that year, and we didn't really burn up the world with offense, but our pitching was great and our defense was outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that 66 is pretty special. I still wear the 1966 World Series ring.
Wow.
And I have both of them, and I love them both. And it's kind of hard to sit here and say which one was my favorite.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, talk about what it was like to have Frank Robinson with you guys, because that's when it turned for the better. What was it like to have him there?
Well, I think it was explained pretty well the first day of spring training, and Frank hit one through the palm trees down in Miami, and I looked over at Andy Etchebarren, and Jim Palmer was standing there, and I said, "Boys, I think we just won the pennant." and we did. I mean, we just, from start to finish that year, we just blew the league away, and we had a great time, and he was, of course, won the Triple Crown.
Right.
What else can you say about that? And I learned a lot about hitting from Frank, and from watching him, and from being on second base. He was hitting behind me sometimes, and I would get on in front of him and watch the way that he hit from second base. And I learned a lot by watching him.
Wow.
Not even talking, just watching him.
Wow.
The way that he played the game.
That's amazing. And my last question for you, Boog. Your real name is John Wesley Powell.
That's right.
And how did you get the name Boog?
Well, over the years, there's been a lot of different versions, but the one that my Aunt Jean tells is that back in the early 1940s, like in 1942 or 1943,
mm-hmm.
There was a radio show on the air called Dr. Boogit, B-O-O-G-I-T.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a local radio show in Lakeland, Florida. And my Aunt Eunice came to the house one day and said, "How's that little Boogit doing?" And it just got, somehow it just got shortened. That's all I got. And, you know, Dizzy Dean interviewed me one time on the air, and he said, "Son, that's a terrible nickname." He says, "You got to do something about that nickname." You know, and here's a guy named Dizzy.
You're right.
And he's got a brother named Daffy. You know, and he's talking about my nickname. Come on, man. But anyway, and people started booing me and that kind of thing, or booging me, and it was good. I could tell though when they were booing or when they were booging. You could hear the G.
Wow. Boog Powell, listen, it was an honor to have you. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Good talking to you.
Take care.